Hey everyone, welcome to another Your Amigos ASCO GU podcast. We're pleased to be joined today by Misha Beltran from Dana-Farber. First-time guest, Misha, we really appreciate you joining. Congrats on the data. If you want to just introduce yourself briefly and then talk about the DLL3 T-cell engager data that you presented at ASCO GU, maybe a little bit of background first.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks, Brian. Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me. So I am a medical oncologist at Dana-Farber. I focus on prostate cancer, my clinical practice, and also I have a lab, and my lab studies different aspects of prostate cancer. But for a long time, we've been really interested in lineage plasticity and this subgroup of prostate cancers that can evolve and transform from an adenoma to a neuroendocrine histology. And, you know, this happens in other cancer types as well. And so there's a lot of shared mechanisms there. And so that kind of led us to this target of DLL3, delta-like protein 3, and what we're presenting at GU ASCO is interesting.
Misha, just before you get there, before you get there, could you... So there's got a new endocrine thing. Like, we know a lot about it in lung cancer. In kidney cancer, Brian talks a lot about sarcomatoid disease. And is it a spectrum of the same disease of prostate cancer? Is it something completely distinct? What's the mechanism of getting from, you know, Gleason 3+4 to neuroendocrine? Was it always there? Does it develop? What's the clonality? You know, what do you understand about this disease at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've learned a lot over the years. I think the major finding is that these are prostate luminal adeno cell of origin, so they're not coming from another sort of neuroendocrine cell. So that distinguishes them from other neuroendocrine or small cell carcinomas in other sites. And so they have the same genomics as prostate cancer, but they change their identity through epigenetic factors, and whether they're hardwired to begin with or versus, you know, completely acquiring these, you know, with treatment is not really well established. But I would say that once they, you know, acquire these epigenetic changes, they also can lose RBP53, which we commonly see in small cell lung cancers. And then they start to share a lot of the same drivers as other small cell carcinomas, like across all the different sites of origin. And I think this concept of divergent differentiation or tumors kind of changing the way they look and act to try to evade treatment or some kind of other selective pressure is, you know, a shared mechanism across many cancers. And I do think that we can learn a lot from different cancers, but also for prostate cancer, you know, they do have some unique considerations. I think one of the biggest considerations is that it's not black or white. I think there's more heterogeneity in prostate cancer than there is in, for instance, EGFR lung cancers that transform to small cell, where you kind of see a complete histologic transformation, where our patients tend to kind of progress slower or have different disease across metastasis, which makes it a really challenging disease to diagnose and to treat.
Yeah, Misha, one more question, sort of clinical question is, how common is it? I mean, you know, at Vanderbilt, where we are geographically, we see a ton of small cell lung cancer, and I feel like I've seen more small cell prostate in the last 4 years than I've seen in the previous 20. Is it just better recognized? Is it better diagnosed? And like, what percent of prostate cancer patients do you think have this dedifferentiation?
I mean, a lot of it has to do with definitions, but I think that definitely there's more awareness, like even in the community, someone that's developing liver mets with a PSA, very low PSA, you know, they might want to do a biopsy, whereas I think 10 years ago, that was never really done. And then we also have better treatment, AR-targeted therapies that are changing the natural, you know, just changing the resistance mechanisms to hormonal therapies. And I would say that based on biopsies and autopsies, probably about 15 to 20% of tumors lose their AR dependence, their kind of luminalness, whether they're pure small cell or have some other, you know, sort of mixed features. It's hard to really say for sure because the studies have defined neuroendocrine in so many different ways. But I would say that, you know, it's because there is a spectrum, I think somewhere between 15 to 20% of patients are the patients that are probably not going to respond as well to your traditional prostate cancer therapies and maybe, you know, a population where they could be targeted in a different way.
And Misha, I'm sorry about being a pain in the ass, but I've got one more question. What?
No swearing on the podcast, remember?
I don't think ass is a swear word, actually.
Brian. I'm pretty sure it is, but anyway.
We'll discuss that later. what percentage of neuroendocrine differentiation defines it as a neuroendocrine, number one? And number two is, we seem to be using the terms small cell and neuroendocrine interchangeably. Is that correct?
Yeah, so these are great questions. We actually just had this, I just helped organize this pathology workshop actually recently to try to be a little bit better in the way we define this. These are poorly differentiated neuroendocrine carcinomas, which encompass small cell, but could when you get a biopsy, you can see a poorly differentiated carcinoma, but might not be so easy to detect the morphologic features with these small biopsies. So commonly, pathologists reflex to IHC for neuroendocrine markers. And so it's been quite challenging to, say that they're all small cell, if you can't really necessarily sometimes distinguish in these post-treated tumors. And then if you just define by IHC, that's also problematic because they could have some adeno or AR dependence there. So I think that's where I think a lot of the challenges lie. And so if we could be better at the way we define them in our, so some of the studies use morphology, like the studies that we've led, some of the studies have used IHC only. That's why I think neuroendocrine is not the best term, but it kind of encompasses this entire spectrum. And so there isn't really a cutoff for percent positivity to be considered neuroendocrine.
And Misha, one last sort of clinical question for me before we go on to the data. We like to wait about 20 minutes before we get to the actual data.
at least 20 minutes.
In the old days, we used to send like chromogranin A and other sort of serum markers. I remember doing that sort of back in the day, so to speak. Is that done anymore? I don't really do it because we get pathology, but is there any
role? Was Abraham Lincoln still in power at that time, Brian? Before or after?
Yes.
Abraham
Lincoln?
Yes. I do it still, to be honest, but it's hard to act on just a serum marker. But some of these patients could have very high CEAs or chromogranins, and sometimes they have low PSAs, and so sometimes I check it. I think there's lots of work by our group and others to look at cell-free DNA, looking at methylation patterns and things like that that may be a little bit more specific for the, because you can get serum chromogranin going up in basically any context, not necessarily specific for neuroendocrine prostate cancer. But I think it's, I don't know how there's not really good data to say to do it, but I do it sometimes.
Misha, run through what you did in your drug. Let's hear the top. Let's hear what we're here for. Let's hear the excitement.
Okay, so this drug, HPN328, is a T-cell engager. It binds delta-like protein 3, DLL3. This is a protein that's aberrantly expressed at the cell surface of almost all, the vast majority of poorly differentiated neuroendocrine carcinomas, small cell lung cancer, neuroendocrine prostate, and other neuroendocrine small cell carcinomas, small cell bladder. And this is I can talk about what it is, but I'll tell you about the drug first. The drug binds to DLL3 on tumor cells, binds to CD3 on T cells, and brings the T cells to the tumor microenvironment to elicit an immune response. It's a trispecific, so it has a third arm. It binds to albumin to extend half-life. And this is a ongoing phase one study. So it's still in dose escalation. A total of 85 patients have been enrolled, 61 treated at a 1 milligram priming dose, which was de-escalated to 1 milligram due to CRS events at the higher dose for the priming. And there are multiple cohorts, weekly and biweekly cohorts that have been enrolled so far. And the trial is open to all kinds of neuroendocrine carcinomas, small cell lung cancer, neuroendocrine prostate, and other neuroendocrine carcinomas. And so for the GU patients, there haven't been that many GU patients enrolled, 21 GU patients, 15 neuroendocrine prostate cancer patients, median lines of therapy, 3. So all these patients have had platinum. Most of them have visceral mets. I think 62% had liver metastasis. And overall, the MTD has not been reached for the target dose, and it's been well tolerated. But as you know, with T cell engagers, the most common side effects are immune related. Cytokine release syndrome occurred in 59% of patients, but were mostly grade one or grade two, and mostly occur with the first dose. So the drug is given as a priming dose, and then the target dose a week later. And then patients are transitioned to outpatient. So for those first two doses, they're hospitalized. ICANS is another neurologic toxicity that's immune-related toxicity. It's neurologic. That occurred in 8 patients, were grade 1 and grade 2. And then as far as efficacy, you know, there's about 50 patients that had at least one post-baseline scan treated at this 1 milligram priming dose cohorts. And for the overall population, the response rate was 56%, confirmed response 31%, and disease control rate 68%. And for the GU patients, you know, again, still kind of relatively small numbers, but there have been a few deep responses, PRs, one CR, and almost all the neuroendocrine prostate cancer patients had at least some degree of tumor shrinkage. And so what we do highlight in the presentation is the prostate patients that several of them have been treated beyond radiographic progression due to clinical benefit. And I think it speaks to that heterogeneity that we're talking about, where we can see differences in tumor and DLL3 expression across metastasis. And so I think, you know, potentially that we're getting some clinical benefit by targeting these more aggressive clones. But then I think, you know, we may need to think about combination strategies also for these patients. But this is still, you know, very much early data, and we continue to enroll and do a bunch of correlatives. And I think I think duration of response is going to be important. But I think overall, you know, encouraging that we see this sort of very difficult population, very difficult cancer to treat, that we're seeing some activity.
Misha, if you gave them chemotherapy, what would you expect? What response rate would you expect? If you had you given them chemotherapy, because you haven't cured them, you know, you've got disease control in all the prostate cancer patients, what would you expect chemotherapy to do in this sort of population? Is it as good as chemotherapy in your mind, or has you got better results than chemo? I know it's an indirect comparison, it's a small number and all the bits and pieces, but in your clinical experience, is this kind of in the chemotherapy ballpark? Is it better than expected, or are you a little bit disappointed?
Well, I mean, these are patients that have had platinum chemotherapy. Many of them have had platinum IO because we extrapolate from small cell lung cancer. And what do we give them? You know, lubrinectedin, topotecan, really not great options, you know, in this line of setting in a small cell carcinoma post-platinum. And so, you know, I think that you know, we don't have good data for the activity of lubrinectedin and neuroendocrine prostate cancer. We are presenting some retrospective data at GU ASCO, you know, but I would say that, you know, disease control, we've seen some stable disease and some tumor shrinkage, but very transient in general in our experience here.
And so, Misha, about those patients, two questions. One, the patients who were treated beyond progression for clinical benefit. My experience is when these patients progress, they do poorly, right? They're like small cell lung, they respond wonderfully. And when they progress, it goes wrong quickly. So I'm just curious if the treatment beyond progression here is somehow different, you know, or what was that like in these particular patients, if you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I can tell you like about patients that I treated who had very bulky pelvic disease, big prostate, catheter, was, you know, poor, you know, not doing that great in general, and had all of that kind of shrunk down, and he was able to become more functional and feel better and was treated beyond progression, but he had these growing other metastasis, but he didn't have any, but overall symptomatically, you know, energy and, you know, all that stuff kind of improved. And so whether, you know, whether it had to do with the fact that there was a lack of alternative options for these types of patients versus, you know, but I do think that we do, you know, weigh, I mean, these aren't, it's not benign to stay on a phase one trial if you're not benefiting. So I don't know. I think we need more data, but I think that, you know, for this type of population, I think it's meaningful to have those mixed responses in some of these patients.
And,
so
Yeah, agreed. The second part was about durability, and maybe you don't know, or maybe it's too early, but you know, any durable responses in this population would be notable.
Yeah, it's hard to know. I think our longest patient with prostate has been on for 11 months, but you know, we still don't have all that data yet.
Yeah. Misha, you got some activity, and it looks promising. You enticed us with the word combination rather than biomarker. What does that mean?
Yeah, well, you know, I think how do we do better? I didn't mention the DLL3 status. So for small cell lung cancer and neuroendocrine prostate cancer, pre-screening wasn't required. But for the other cancers, you know, DLL3 IHC had to be done on the tumor to confirm positivity. And all the neuroendocrine prostate cancer patients actually did have DLL3 positivity. There was a range of expression. And so one thing gets to, you know, how much target do you need for these T cell engagers? Can you potentially, by bringing the immune cells to the tumor microenvironment, you know, sensitize even non-DLL3 expressing cells? Is there a bystander effect, you know, non-DLL3 expressing cells? Or can you also leverage that to combine with immunotherapy? And there actually is a cohort now open for the small cell lung cancer only of HPN328 with atezo. And so, you know, we'll see what the safety is there. But I think it's an intriguing possibility to these tumors that tend to not respond to traditional immunotherapy to try to combine with something like a T cell engager. But also I think with neuroendocrine prostate cancer, because we have these mixed populations, could we, you know, target multiple populations? Like, you know, we have PSMA and B7H3 and STEAP1 and all these new cell surface targets that may not be, and DLL3 is a unique cellular population. So one can envision, you know, maybe we need combination strategies to target different types of cells within these tumors. So I think that's also, you know, quite interesting. And we didn't look at PSMA scans in these patients, but, you know, enough DLL3 imaging is in development. So it might be interesting in the future to think about something like that.
And I guess, Misha, just that sort of leads us into maybe talking a little bit more about the toxicity, which you mentioned, and obviously that plays into combination strategies. And maybe I'll make it a broad question for these kinds of what I would call more intense T cell therapies in prostate. There's some toxicity. This can be a challenging population because of age and comorbidities. I mean, how much is toxicity going to limit either development of this, either this one drug or this type of drug, or just the field of, you know, more intense immune therapy in prostate cancer, if that question made sense?
Yeah, I mean, well, I think the fact that we have to hospitalize patients for their first two doses is, you know, not minimal. It's hard to do. It would be hard to expand this across broadly, I would say, unless kind of change, if we can start changing the way we think about that, and try to, you know, it's hard to know who's at risk for CRS. I've mentioned it's usually the first priming dose, but, you know, it's hard to know who it's going to happen to and how to mitigate that. And are there better ways to give these drugs? I think that they'll have to be, I think, moving forward as these drugs, more and more T cell engagers get improved across different cancer types, because I don't think our hospitals can handle that. and our patient population in prostate is different. As you mentioned, they're older, they have a lot of other things going on. So I've been encouraged so far by this study that we haven't, you know, had major events, but I think, you know, it has been an issue for some of the other new immunotherapies for prostate, CAR T and some of the other T cell engagers. So we'll see.
Misha, we had a great talk from Kevin Kelly about STEAP1 from ESMO, a bispecific. You've trumped him with your trispecific. Congratulations on that. STEAP1 looked really active. It was also a T cell engager. One, I guess, is more widely expressed on prostate cancer, where your DLL3 is more specific to neuroendocrine tumors. Is this a new chapter in prostate cancer? Is this something that's worthwhile pursuing? Is this the two of dozens of drugs coming through? or is this just a coincidence that two drugs with a similar mechanism of action with some activity have come up in prostate cancer within a 3 or 4 month period?
Yeah, well, these aren't the first T cell engagers. The PSMA drugs were developed before, but I do think that this is, I was excited about the STEAP1 data, and I think that what these trials are showing us is that we can give them safely to our patients, and that they can be active, and whether now it's going to be about further pursuit of T cell engagers, also further pursuit of the target. You know, there's been ADCs for STEAP1. There'll be new drugs. There are new drugs in development for DLL3 beyond T cell engagers. So I think we are. I would go beyond saying, new wave of development just for T cell engagers. I would say for cell surface targets in prostate, and PSMA was the kind of the first wave of that. But there's now so many that I think are creating a lot of excitement, and I think the benefit is that we could move towards better biomarker selection for things that we can actually measure.
And Misha, we sort of speaking broadly of immune therapy and prostate cancer, the PD-1, PD-L1s have largely been disappointing. There was a couple negative big trials at ESMO, et cetera, but data at ASCO GU around Cabo plus Atezo that I think for many people, at least for me, sort of came out of left field. Cabo has a history as monotherapy, didn't get over the line, the PD-1 or in this case PD-L1 history I just mentioned, but now we have an RPFS advantage for the combination. Do you have a thought about that? Is this sort of a one-off, can't explain it to random chance, or are PD-1 inhibitors back, in prostate? Is there still room to develop them in prostate cancer?
Yeah, I think, the trials were disappointing. The trials of the AR pathway inhibitor, actually multiple trials looking at combination strategies. And I think I don't think immunotherapy is completely over, but I do think that combination strategies, could be the key, whether it's going to be cabozantinib, or something else like a T cell engager or something else to try to prime the immune system to respond to these drugs. I think what's very clear is that, we shouldn't be just randomly throwing them at patients, and we should be kind of more informed. And I have to see the data for that study. And I know there was no cabozantinib alone arm, and we know that there's PFS benefit from prior studies, and to try to understand what's the contribution of the immunotherapy there. But there was preclinical data to suggest that there is some immunomodulatory effect from these VEGF inhibitors. So we'll see. I hate to throw out a whole class of drugs for prostate cancer, even though we've been disappointed time and time again.
Misha, my last question I should have asked at the beginning. In neuroendocrine tumors, what immune parameters, do you have in baseline expression? Is it high levels of PD-L1? Is it higher TMB? Is there T effector type signatures? Do you know much about the immune infiltration of this subgroup of prostate cancer?
So we've looked a little bit at sort of the immune profiling, immunogenomic profiling of these neuroendocrine prostate cancers, comparing them to prostate cancer like CRPC and also small cell lung cancer, and they are more like prostate cancer and less like even though small cell lung cancer I wouldn't classify as a particularly hot tumor, but immunotherapy is approved for small cell lung cancer, and the reason we looked at this was because oftentimes we treat neuroendocrine prostate cancer like small cell lung cancer, and the TMB is low. This was a lot of it was immunogenomic analysis, so there's caveats to that, but there really wasn't any sense that these were sort of like some of the other cancers that respond very well. So but again, whether we can leverage that by using alternative ways, and whether we should be giving people atezo or any sort of checkpoint inhibitors for neuroendocrine prostate cancer, I think is still an open question. There are some trials that are looking at that.
Do you do that? Maybe my last question, do you do that in clinic, say outside a trial? If you're giving an initial chemotherapy to a neuroendocrine patient, do you give carboplatin atezo or just carboplatin or something else?
I personally, if it's a patient that has sort of some mixed features or, you know, evolving from prostate adenocarcinomas, I usually give it platinum taxane if they haven't seen that, and continue ADT. But if it's a, you know, really a pure small cell, you know, PSA zero, especially de novo, I would treat that patient like a small cell lung cancer and do the whole thing, maintenance and all of that stuff. But it all depends on the context.
Misha, thanks so much for your time today. I'm looking forward to seeing you very soon.
And
congratulations on your really exciting new drug.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah,
it's a pleasure.
You clearly, nice to speak to you. Clearly have a command of this disease. Thanks for sharing your expertise.
Certainly,
with us.
We appreciate it. Certainly much more than me and Brian. That came very apparent quite early on.
By some distance, yes.
Misha, it's lovely to
thanks,
speak
Misha.
To you.
Thanks, Misha. Take care.
See you soon. Bye-bye.
Take care. Thanks.